Welcome to Creating Sanctuary, a global interview series featuring 21 heroes who are saving animals' lives. I'm your host, Yolanda Calderon, and the hero I'm interviewing today is Anne Goody. Anne is the executive director and curator of Three Ring Ranch Exotic Animal Sanctuary on the Big Island of Hawaii. She has been working with injured animals since the age of three. Welcome, Anne. Thank you for doing the work you do. I'm so happy you could join us.
Well, thank you for inviting me and giving me a venue to talk out.
So I'm going to ask you what you were doing just before this, because you started telling me and I interrupted you because I wanted this to be a part of the interview. Could you explain what an average day is in the life of Anne Goody and Three Ring Ranch?
Oh, gosh, an average day. So starting at about 6 a.m., I get up and answer emails. Some of them are from people wanting to visit. Some are with animals in need of help. Some urgent from wherever in the world they may be. Some are from children asking for information for a homework project or scientific project that they're working on. Get that out of the way and start cutting up monkey food. Now, monkey food. Okay, that's in itself quite a project. They get an amazing diet. And the only way to make that amazing diet is with the help of our friends at Safeway. So today, even though my husband normally does the 7 a.m. Safeway run, and he did it today, I did my normal animal feeding, finished at about 10:30, raced off to the airport to pick up a new German international volunteer who's going to live with us for 6 weeks and learn all about how we care for our animals and our facilities before she starts into the university for a degree in biology.
Now, wonderful.
On the way back with this poor young lady who had spent the last day and a half traveling, she had a 12-hour layover in LAX, I stopped at Safeway to pick up food for her so she had what she needs to eat. And I got grabbed by one of the produce guys saying, you need to take a look in back. We've got some more stuff for you. Now, I thought maybe they had a box of mixed grapes and nuts and things like that. Walked in the back and said, uh-oh. There was stacked several shopping carts full plus piles of things on the floor. 3 cases of apples, 2 more cases of bananas, snap peas, pre-cut up food vegetable trays. And I went, oops, we have a Fiesta, and it already has a suitcase in it. So I looked at Kimberly and said, welcome to the life of Three Ring Ranch. We're going to go driving around the back and haul all this out through the back of a grocery store. And her eyes just kind of got really big, and she dug right in. She's got what it takes. So when I come home with this kind of load, we've got 2 large full-size refrigerators in the garage, and we've got several carts that some of the non-refrigeratables can go on for all the animals, because we couldn't have adopted the creatures we have without the incredible help of a grocery store like Safeway. But we are on an island, and there are other facilities who are, like us, trying to do great things for animals. So I made phone calls, and I have some folks from a parrot sanctuary who are working their way toward becoming accredited, and they're on their way down. They'll be here in about 30 minutes. And for them, this is a lifeline because they don't have the access that we do. We've worked with this grocery store for 19 years, and they just don't let anyone in the back door. But we can share.
Oh,
so
that's
my day so far, and it's only 2:22 our time.
That's a great story. So tell me about the animals that you deal with. I know you do exotics, but you also did wildlife rescue, right?
We did. For about 16 years, we did wildlife rehab. We were the only wildlife rehabber on the Big Island, and for some of the species, the only one in the state. And we were the only ones doing bats. We were the only ones doing seabirds and raptors and forest birds on this island. Then we have a wonderful raptor rehabber now, and then another facility doing native species. So we are the exotic animal where you go if no one else wants you place. We are the home for the misfit animals, whether it be native non-releasables, whether it be the monkey in the bedroom. And yes, we actually have a monkey that people tried to raise in the bedroom, which we all know that's not a great idea. And when he got to be about 11, he strangled the cat. Ate the eyeballs. The owner was screaming and panicking. And this sweet capuchin monkey, who was raised by this nice but crazy lady, thought she wanted some. There was nothing wrong with Johnny. Johnny's a capuchin, and capuchins are hunting monkeys, and he got to be a teenage hunting monkey and did what they do. He decided that cat was not just a buddy, it was something to eat. And the nice lady who was raising him didn't understand that he didn't understand, she doesn't understand his language. And this is where people get in trouble with animals all the time. They put their human behaviors and their human beliefs on an animal, and their arrogance. We as humans are arrogant, and we think that the animal should accept us, that we can mold them into what we want, and we can't. Johnny was just a monkey doing what monkeys do. And when he got fed up with her screaming and yelling, he did attack, and she ended up with some lovely scars and missing part of an ear. And Johnny came here. So we're that kind of place that can handle those kind of creatures. We can handle owner surrenders. We can handle state or federal placement. If an animal, if a board of directors decides that the animal is inappropriate, and to make that decision, our board has me go evaluate the animal. I go look at it, health reason, what financial impact it would have against us. I go look at how it would impact our volunteers and the other animals who already live here, because the other residents own this place. As a true sanctuary, they're here for life. And then our board makes that decision if the animal can come. And if it can come, then we go get it here. And it becomes a lifelong member. If for some reason our board of directors feels that the animal would either cause the volunteers to all run screaming down the driveway, or make us financially in a place we shouldn't be, or for whatever other reason that they vote against it, then my job is to help get that animal to a facility where it can live its entire life safely. And being that we live in the middle of a rock, in the middle of an island, you know, the farthest landmass from any continent, that means the mainland. And that would be, an example would be a wolf dog that was smuggled in here, or a sugar glider, or three colobus monkeys. All of those creatures our board voted against and went to the mainland. And that was quite a challenge getting them there, but that's part of who we are and what we do.
So you're saying that each animal, before it comes to you, has to go through a board approval?
Correct. Now, there are emergency situations where we move very, very quickly. When we're contacted by the state or by the feds and they say, we've got this animal in a situation that is untenable for the animal or safety of the residents in the surrounding area, and they are going to either go in and seize it, and in that case they may euthanize it. That will be an urgent situation. If it's not on this island, I will fly over, make an evaluation, get it to the board, and they'll usually respond within 12 hours. So we've had that kind of situation that's very, very quick. But yes, our board actually has to vote to accept an animal for residence. Mm-hmm. We do take animals that are owner surrenders that aren't going to become permanent residents, that we will get healthy, get well, run them through quarantine, and get them placed in the case of like a chinchilla, a rabbit, a guinea pig.
And so, for example, Johnny the capuchin, what kind of life does he have since he was raised with a human? What kind of environment does he have now to live in?
Well, he has a really large natural habitat. He's got towers. He's got a bedroom. He's got a capuchin directly adjacent to him that he can groom and touch. He's actually, it's his older sister, 3 years apart. So he's got her right next door. He, when he came, had to go through withdrawal. His human had given him cigarette butts, which she thought he could rub on his skin to be healthy and keep insects away. And in that case, he did rub them on himself, and then he groomed it off and was a little nicotine fiend. She also gave him caffeine. She thought coffee was good for her, therefore he could have it. She gave him chocolate. She gave him a hot dog every night, and every evening she also gave him a little whiskey. That poor little guy had quite a bit to go through to become physically healthy and mentally healthy. Once he realized he was a monkey and got to behave like one, life became very good. Now, he is our youngest current resident, a non-human primate of a gang of five, and he's probably got another 25 years with us.
Tell me about your background and about the beginnings of Three Ring Ranch.
Okay, do we have an hour? I've always loved animals, always cared for animals. I used to be the kid that the first grade teacher would call when the guinea pig wasn't feeling well, and I'd come down and sit with it in turn and say, he needs to be outside more, or he needs some grass, his poops are too hard. And it was pretty much a joke. They would always say that, you know, before you take it to a vet, at least ask little Ann what she thinks. And I was always going to be a vet and worked for a vet. And that was my lifelong dream and my plan. And as I worked for Dr. Schramm, I saw things where an animal would die of parvo or distemper because the owner had failed to get it a $5 vaccine. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to handle the owners. I just wasn't. There was no way I was going to be able to deal with the pet owners in these kind of situations. So I told the vet school, told UC Davis I wasn't going to come. It just wasn't going to happen. So at that point, I just figured there was no way I was going to have any customers. I would fire all the humans, and then it just wasn't going to work. So I decided that the animals were always going to be my hobby. And I had gotten out of high school very, very young, and by some fluke ended up in nursing school when someone dropped out due to a pregnancy. And I graduated from nursing school. I was just about 18 and making a great living. We moved up to the mountains. I got married to my first husband, and I did worked for Fish and Wildlife and BLM and Forest Service and got to take care of all the strange misfits on night and weekend call while I was working as a nurse. So I made a great living but got to work with animals and life was good. My first husband and I divorced. I ended up coming to Hawaii to start over and got married again. The day after our wedding reception, I was struck in the face by lightning and I had to learn to walk and talk again. Yeah, it was a big wake-up call. And I was running a business, 80 employees, doing the American dream, you know, work hard, make money, buy stuff. And I had to start over. So it was a very humbling scenario. I was finishing my dissertation and couldn't talk, and I had to defend it. And, you know, time's up. They give you extensions, but eventually you have to do it. My husband asked me what he could do to help, and I probably meant let's go to Paris, but I said the word zebra. And that's truly what happened. I mean, when I said zebra, he said, okay. So I blame it all on Norm. And we are still married 21 years later. He looked up the zebras in Hawaii at the Molokai Safari Park, which had closed. The animals were dying of starvation and being hunted. It was a bad situation. Over 400 animals ended up dying that way. But he contacted the lawyer. The lawyer said, have her call me. And he just handed me the lawyer's phone number and said, here, you want a zebra? Talk to this guy. And it was a gauntlet. So I talked to him. I had to figure out what I was going to say. I ended up going in front of the state, the Department of Ag, the Attorney General, a bunch of people. And they looked at my background and saw the years of wildlife rehab and said, you can have all the exotic animal permits you want if you will do what rehab for us. And that was the deal. That's how Three Ring Ranch happened. Most sanctuaries are accidental. Yeah, the accidental sanctuary.
You started talking about that when we first spoke. You had some cautionary words about starting a sanctuary and mentioned that most sanctuaries had accidental beginnings.
Sure, they're usually someone gets an animal that may have been abused or may be struggling, realizes they can do a great job caring for it. The animal improves. They get another one and another one and another one.
Mm-hmm.
My huge caution is don't become an animal hoarder. Mm-hmm. To start a sanctuary, consider $1 million in the bank, lots of land, either that or a great patron, plenty of land, lots of volunteers willing to help. Mm-hmm. I totally recommend you don't do it. I recommend you start to work for an existing sanctuary and understand it You get to mm-hmm. know what it's involved first. You get a real good from the ground up foundation. And then if you truly think you can do it, you start from the bottom. You do a purpose-built facility instead of a coincidental or an accidental sanctuary like we were. I mean, we had the land. Luckily, I had worked hard, did have money in reserve. My husband still is a physician. He's practicing. I do have a good income from prior investments and disability prior to the lightning. So we can survive and do this. For the first 9 years, we were in the red. And it mm-hmm. it did take a long time and quite a bit to build up, and we're 100% volunteer. But that's very unusual. And if someone wants to start a sanctuary, they have to start small. You have to grow reasonably. You need to take the time to do the steps right. You have to understand what a USDA license is, what being accredited means. Mm-hmm. To you, to the animals, to your future. It means it's forever. The animals yep. who live here at this ranch own it. They actually own it. It's in trust for them. They're going to outlive me. I'm 57, going to be 58 in April. There's animals here who are going to outlive me by 30 or 40 or 50 years. You know, how is that going to continue? It's in trust for them. We have a wonderful board of directors. We have people in the future. We've got kids who have gone on to college who are now vets, people who are coming back. I mean, I look and watch at these kids knowing that some of them are going to take over this place.
Right. So you're always thinking about the future. You mentioned that you've had to take over animals from other sanctuaries that could no longer stay open. Without any specific, of course, can you tell us about that?
Some have been facilities closing of their own choosing. Some have been mm-hmm. because of finances, and others have been because either the states or the feds have stepped in. It is one scary, scary day when you're invited by the feds to come when they are coming to seize animals. They will tell you about it. They're not telling the owner of the facility. You are flown over there. They're in body armor. They've got marshals with them. They've got automatic weapons. You're waiting at some discreet point in a vehicle, and they've got radios on, and they're calling and saying, and you hear this, all secure, and then you're driven in, and you've got to walk around, evaluate animals. You're there to seize certain specific animals that their authority covers, and that may be fish and wildlife and migratory bird. It may be the state, and maybe your division of forestry, and you have to take those animals from someone who's been caring for them and take them to a secondary location and then evaluate them. Probably the saddest was taking a group of animals, including raptors and forest birds, who had been cared for by a very kind person who did not believe in euthanasia. And we are talking blind animals who had spent years circling the bottom of a cage. Animals with fractures that had never healed, that had wings flopping. Mm-hmm. Things that I will never unsee that are in my head. Mm-hmm. And those animals, we just one after another looked at. The feds looked at me and said, can you use this animal for education? And I said, we would never allow this animal to be used in an educational program in this condition. It is suffering. And mm-hmm. then they said, okay. Euthanize. And I had to go one after another and euthanize them all. There were a couple of little songbirds that were juveniles that I said, these may be salvageable. And that was the end of the day, just taking those few little birds, and everything else had to be euthanized. I had three interns with me. Two were second-year vet students. One was a pre-vet. We had been talking and laughing all the way on the plane going over. They had a little private plane with us. And on the way back, I don't think anyone said more than 10 words. There were some tears. Everyone was trying to just get what we had done out of our heads. Mm-hmm. It was just not pretty at all.
Right. So that was more of a hoarding case. It wasn't really truly a sanctuary.
But it also was a situation where they called themselves a sanctuary. They had all kinds of farm animals as well, but the situation there was they didn't believe in euthanasia at any time. So there were a lot of animals who were in pretty miserable condition, both farm animals, domestic animals, and, of course, these wild animals. Yeah, so it was pretty tough.
Yeah, sounds like it. So changing the pace a little bit, I noticed you call yourself a curator. You're the executive director and curator at the sanctuary. Can you explain what that word means and why you call yourself that?
Well, curator is the keeper of the place. To me, when you say curator, just like you would refer it to at a museum or a gallery, that's the person who takes care of the artwork, not the physical day-to-day dusting of the statue, but overseeing that these pieces are cared for at the best possible way, with the best possible setting, the best lighting, the best amount of oil in the frame. Mm. I look at the animals here as treasures. I look at them as creatures we share our planet with. I don't look at them and say, this is my zebra, as in, like, this is my rake, mm-hmm. in that kind of possessive way. I look at it like I would say, this is my brother, mm-hmm. because you don't possess your brother. You share your world with your brother. I think of my zebra as not mine, as the zebra that I share the ranch with. So as a curator, when I'm looking at Patty or Zoe or one of the other creatures, I'm looking at them as a unique entity that needs to be cared for in the most special way that is beneficial to that living being, like mm-hmm. you would showcase that piece of art. So the word curator to me is the one focused on doing that.
Even though you make it pretty clear on the website that these animals are not on display, these animals are there for their own well-being and to live out their lives as well as they possibly can. And you facilitate that.
Correct.
Yeah.
They Beautiful. Are used for education. We do have educational programs at the mm-hmm. animals comfort in time and frequency, and believe me, they let you know when you're coming too frequently or not frequently enough. They seem to get quite a kick out of when I come through with a group of people, and these groups are very small and only led by me. They will react to us. They will come close and look, and they gawk at us. And it is an unusual feeling to be the creatures in the zoo rather than to be the people at the zoo gawking at the animals. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're the ones gawking at us. It's a very different perspective. And we come very respectfully to learn about them.
Sounds like how all zoos should be, actually. Here are the people putting themselves on display for the animals.
Right. We are actually working on a project that we hope will be a demonstration model that will be used first at the Honolulu Zoo, and we'll see where it goes from there. And it is a very brief orientation for guests when they come to the zoo to help you understand how to communicate with animals in a way that is not a threat, how to learn to move your body so that you're not saying you're here to eat them or to scare them, how to move like one who eats salad. And then they would get a bracelet for those who have gone through this voluntary orientation that says, I know how to talk to the animals or something like that. But it would be a loudly colored bracelet that they would wear. And then there would be observers scattered, voluntary observers scattered throughout the zoo, watching to see the way the animals cue in or react to the people who had learned respectful behavior. No hand waving, no high-pitched squealing, no running ever. This kind of gentle movement that the animals feel comfortable around, where they don't lift their heads up and move away, where they instead watch and maybe take a couple steps toward.
Mm-hmm.
And it mm-hmm. would be fascinating to see what percent of difference that we have from people who do move that way versus people who move like normal, arrogant humans.
Absolutely. In fact, that was on my list of questions to ask you. So I noticed that you have this topic of discussion on your website. You mention it. How do we communicate with animals without even speaking? And I guess that's what you're talking about, how to eat, how to move like a salad eater. I love that expression.
Well, okay, so when I lost such a big chunk of my brain and had to learn to walk and talk again, I lost a big part of what you have that makes you uniquely human. You filter extraneous things from your input of what's coming at you so you can focus on speech. And mm-hmm. speech is something relatively new in evolution, and humans develop this wonderful ability and our brains changed. Well, the animals don't do this. They're constantly aware of every little bit of data around them. They have to be, or someone could come and eat them. So they've got to know if it's going to be a stressor, if it's going to be aggressive, if it's safe, if it's passive. So we have to be aware that every little thing we're doing is being interpreted by them, even whether we don't mean it to be that way, but just our movement. If we walk straight towards something without the little bit of swivel in the hip and our arms are moving forward of us, that is how a predator moves. And your claw, your talon, your hands is what they interpret it as, is a threat. So the animal steps back or the head raises. It becomes more wary. Yet if you move with that rocking swivel in the middle and the hands calmly down to your side and you lead slightly with one shoulder, you'll see, for instance, the bison who's watching us up at the barn drop his head. He drops mm-hmm. into the normal, contented bison posture rather than keeping his head up, wondering if this is a pack approaching him. And we try to tell him, no, it's just a herd. Now, he's not an idiot. He doesn't think we're a group of bison. But that initial first visual contact that he has with us, he interprets as one that isn't threat. And
absolutely.
This is what I teach here. This is what the vet students come to learn. We have second year and fourth year vet students come in a program, they stay with us for 3 weeks and learn about behavior and communication while they're doing repetitive hands-on care, which unless you do that, you'll never know what an animal's normal is, and you'll be a terrible vet because you can't just look at an animal and know something's wrong. I want
right.
our students to leave here knowing what their normal is so that they can immediately see something's wrong.
Amazing.
There's
a lot
to learn.
Yes. So I have one last question before I let you go and do all the things you need to do today. In terms of animal welfare, in general, what is giving you the most hope right now?
The most hope.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all sanctuaries dream of being put out of business.
Mm-hmm.
We dream about no other animal needing us, no one calling and saying, we're going to go do a raid and we've got these animals and will you take them? Or someone calling after their animal ate the neighbor. Or someone calling and saying, I'm tired of it. Will you please take it?
Mm-hmm.
We want to be out of business. And what I'm seeing more of and gives me the best hope is the young people who come and they get it. They realize that a monkey in the bedroom is not a good pet. That big parrot that their neighbor has is not happy in that cage in the yard just by itself squawking. No matter how many toys the neighbor puts in that cage, it's not okay. It needs to be with its own kind. You know, a parrot alone is a big mistake. And they start seeing this and they start speaking out. I think that gives me the greatest hope. And that's why we try to reach to the kids. They're our future.
Right, and they're getting it. And there's a lot to work with kids because they already have more compassion. They already have that in them.
Well, I think they just haven't had it burnt out of them yet. I think we all start with it. It's just
that's what
become jaded.
Anne Goody, thank you so much for your time on this really busy day. And I also want to thank our listeners and encourage them to go to your website at 3ringranch.org. You've been listening to Creating Sanctuary for Animals, and I'm your host, Yolanda Calderon, and I look forward to talking with you all again soon. Bye-bye.